let me say that if I'm not mistaken, the artist who does the Precious Moments series, and it appears on cards, it appears in figurines, they even have a Precious Moments chapel in Missouri. No, it's close, but this artist, if I'm not mistaken, lost a child. And I believe he is devoting his artwork to the memory of this child. Now, I cannot disparage him, his artistic work. I can only talk about how I encounter his work, okay? So I want to make that very clear. I hate this stuff. Sugartown, Christmas memories past, sweetness this, sweetness that. What's wrong with that? It's not real. It's superficial. It's two-dimensional. Trivializes, you know, the faith. And there is an implicit piety or an implicit spirituality which is conveyed by this kind of artwork. Okay? Some people love it. And that's fine, but if I have an episode sometime, I think I'm going to walk into one of the bookstores that has the whole, you know, line of those with a sledgehammer or something and just take them out. But that's spirituality with an attitude.
Do you have any strong feelings about this?
Well, let's talk about those strong feelings in the context of the 20th century. What has happened in this century? World War I, World War II, the Cold War, the threat of nuclear destruction, the Holocaust. I have heard it said, and I believe it's true, that the 20th century is the bloodiest in human history. Is that true? Okay. In this century, we have seen technologized violence, such as humans have never seen in their history. In the late 20s, 30s, Germans sat together in boardrooms and planned, you know, technologically, bureaucratically, how they would eliminate the Jewish race. They proceeded to kill 6 million of them. Bob Benny this morning said that, you know, what happened in Russia and China, from just the sheer numbers point of view, made the Holocaust look small, not from the point of view of evil, but just in terms of the numbers killed. This is the kind of century we live in, and this stuff just, for me, does not work. It just doesn't work. It does not address reality. And so, yeah, I do react with a lot of passion because, you know, here this stuff is done, you know, kind of in the name of Christian piety or a Christian perspective, and thoughtful people come to this and say, is that all there is? What about the Holocaust? What about, you know, the millions lost? What about the violence on the streets, the epidemic of violence in our cities? I serve an inner city congregation in Pittsburgh, and teaching confirmation to the seventh graders this year, very naively, you know, we were talking about the topic of death. You know, very naively, I said, gee, have you had any grandparents who have died? Oh, yeah, they said. But then they proceeded to tell me about their classmates. This is seventh grade. Who've been shot and killed, you know, on the streets of Pittsburgh. Kids they've grown up playing with, you know, all their lives, shot and killed. This stuff doesn't work in that kind of reality. The threat of nuclear destruction, the threat of environmental chaos and destruction such as we've not seen before. We need a spirituality, a piety, a life of faith. Ken asked what spirituality is. I don't know, you know. When I use spirituality, basically what I'm talking about is lived faith or lived theology. And it's a very broad and sweeping category as far as I'm concerned. Piety is another word, you know, but we need a piety, a spirituality, which can come to terms with address the extremity of the 20th century, pushing now, what, 4 or 5 years toward the 21st century. So that's why I call the spirituality with an attitude, spirituality for realists. You know, spirituality for the 21st century. Now, I'm getting a doctorate in spirituality, whatever that means, from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. About halfway through, I'd finished all the coursework, beginning the dissertation topic selection. my coursework thus far, I'm finding a lot of articulations of spirituality rather two-dimensional, rather superficial. A lot of it centers on practices and disciplines, you know, which we take on to ourselves, and there's this kind of an implicit theology in that, you know, if by my efforts, you know, I will try harder, try harder, try harder, and make myself right with God. Well, of course, Lutheran theology, you know, that just doesn't play. But I know myself. I can't, by my efforts and disciplines, improve my spiritual life very easily. I take on a discipline, do it for a couple weeks, and then it's gone, you know. We need a spirituality that addresses human reality in its finitude and its brokenness, with the mixed motivations that we bring into it. So a lot of spiritual disciplines, you know, simply don't cut it for me. Then we have, you know, New Age stuff, quasi-Gnostic stuff, which really denies, in a sense, you know, the reality of human sin and brokenness and violence. And again, there's the idea, if we really just tap into the good and who we are, you know, everything will be just fine. If we pray hard enough or go to enough seminars on Gnosticism or something like that, you know, everything will be fine. It's very, very naive, you know, in this century. So, spirituality with an attitude, what is it? Let me read something to you. Does anybody know the name John Carmody? Wrote a book called Cancer and Faith. John Carmody had been a Jesuit and left the order, married, but had a bout with cancer and ultimately died of cancer. But he wrote, prior to his death, this book called Cancer and Faith. And here's one little snippet. He writes, O Felix Cancer, that is to say, O fruitful, fortunate, successful Cancer, he goes on, if sickness convinces me of your love, talking to God, of course, his prayer, if sickness convinces me of your love, makes me a credible witness to your utter goodness, it will be the best part of my life. My wife's love has prepared me for this, but only your palpable coming in the form of this terminal illness has brought my hope to crisis. Thank you, my God. I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only say the word, and my dying will seem a pure grace. That is spirituality with an attitude. You know, that is spirituality for realists, I believe. You know, I'll go through this. That is a spirituality for the 21st century. I'm tingling. You know, those words, you know, have a power, a compellingness. Do you agree? I mean, what was your reaction to that? There's a substance there, a life there, a sense of reality there that is lacking in this. You know, lacking in Sugartown Christmas memories past. Thank you. What was your reaction to that? Oh, Felix Cancer.
Does one have to be sick in order to have a spiritual?
Well, I would say we're all sick. I mean, at certain levels. Right. No. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say that. But, I mean, we struggle. My God, we struggle. You know, with this, that, or the other thing, our motivations, or mixed motivations, our sin, our brokenness, our finitude. I'm 33 years old. I'll make that confession. But I serve a congregation where, you know, my joke is, you're youth until age 60. You know, from 60 to 85, you're middle age, and from 85 on, you're a senior citizen. But as a 33-year-old, I'm vicariously participating in the loss, you know, which is the experience of my congregation. They're losing their spouses, their friends. The neighborhood is declining. The city as a whole is going down the tubes. So in the midst of all of this loss, you know, I can't help but, you know, take some of that on myself. So no, we don't have to be terminally ill to participate in this. But that is the spirituality with an attitude.
Yeah. same despair that this other is resurrected, this...
precious moment.
Well, potentially. Again, I can't, you know, I can't... I'm not in the head or the experience of the artist who does that stuff. And so I don't know in what way he has appropriated the experience of the loss of his child, you know, how he's integrated that into... But I'm just saying my reaction, you know, to the work is that, no, this is a form of denial. It's running. It's you know, glossing it over with icing. You know, the seething mass of loss and grief. You know, here's this chocolate, sugary icing, and it just doesn't work.
Well, no. Part of what bothers me about the precious moments thing is it's you take a potentially powerful, graphically, biblical image of an angel,
right,
which is a heavy-duty
right.
stuff. And
that's right,
juicy.
Precisely.
Whereas the grappling with the cancer, I don't know how I like that, but taking very seriously what's going on
right.
here.
Right,
right. What I don't
right.
think about it is attributing to cancer some positive stuff. Whereas I think it's happening in the midst of it, and that's how I would probably say it differently. But
right.
that, for me, is the difference. Is the
yeah. Well, I will say, you know, I'll make this point now and also make it later. You know, the death and mortality suck. I mean, it's you know, death is death. Suffering is suffering. And in this kind of spirituality, in no way do I want to gloss over or trivialize or make it all better, you know. But then there's that in spite of. Somehow, someway, in spite of, between the lines, in through the back door, on the periphery of the crater of loss, you know, there are these new shoots, you know, this new growth. The crucifixion is still the crucifixion. But, there's always that but. I lost my mother to cancer when I was a senior in high school. And... she was ill for most of my growing up. You know, I was going to say that later, too. But, I mean, this has been my struggle. You know, and I remember greeting cards and things I'd get, you know, at the time of her death, you know, looking like the precious moments thing, and it just didn't work for me. It didn't speak. You know, so this is, you know, as well as my doctoral study, this is my own personal, you know, struggle with this. Well, let me talk about this in relation to Lutheranism. I'm a rare breed these days, it seems. I'm very interested in the Lutheran tradition. And I'm very interested in articulating that, you know, for the current milieu and what that means. So I spoke of, you know, the Lutheran charism, spirituality with an attitude. Lutheran charism, what does that mean? Well, Paul talks about, you know, all of us having spiritual gifts. That is true for us individually as members in corporate of the body of Christ. I think that is also true collectively for traditions. You know, the Benedictines will talk about their charism for this or that, or the Carmelites will talk about their charism, their special gift, their special focus of ministry as the religious order. Well, I think Lutheranism has its charism, its unique spirit, its unique emphasis, you know, that brings... it brings to Christianity. And it centers in the person of Martin Luther. You know, if you've read his writings, he's belligerent, earthy, you know. He likes a good beer around the table, and, you know, and there's a reality, you know, to it. Let me talk about the Lutheran charism. Yes, please.
Just make a
sure.
comment about the prayer that you
mm-hmm.
read.
Right.
I really appreciated it, and I think the main reason is because it sounded like the writer really came to terms
right.
with his own kind of terror and death, and as he calls cancer a loving, like a loving companion, I think that he's saying, you know, I'm accepting the fact that the cancer has overtaken me,
mm-hmm.
and this is why, and that's okay, you know, and it's kind of like, you take the whole Lutheran concept, like saint and sinner, it's like he's accepting both
right.
in life.
Right. And that's a paradoxical embrace. Those with whom I've had conversation here know that my proposed doctoral research is going to center on paradox as a narrative, literary, linguistic, philosophical, theological, you know, category which evokes a sense of God's love. We're all in conflict. You know, good, evil, light, darkness, saint, sinner. Paradox is a way of evoking an embrace finally. And so, you know, what Carmody is saying is paradoxical. How on earth can cancer be called Felix? Good, you know, benevolent, successful, you know. It remains contradictory, remains in tension, but somehow, you know, as a rhetorical device, that kind of paradox, you know, brings these contradictions together to create another kind of truth, which is very compelling. But anyway, that's next week's topic. So if you're here, come to the one on paradoxical spirituality. Let me root this in the Lutheran tradition, the theology of the cross. Everybody know what I talk about, what I mean when I talk about the theology of the cross, that the defeat, the humiliation of the crucifixion is God's ultimate victory and power and glory. You know, again, that's paradoxical. But that is thoroughly, you know, part of the Christian tradition and thoroughly, you know, part of the Lutheran tradition. And emanating, as far as I'm concerned, from this theology of the cross, you know, is this earthy realism that can look human reality right in the eye without shying away. Because God has gone to the very depths of who we are as human beings on the cross. I mean, look at it. Here is humanity's attempt to kill God. Can humanity get worse? But then look, God turns that upside down, and it becomes the source, once and for all time, of our redemption. There it is. So with that, you know, lift the veil on the fullness of human reality with its good points, its bad points. We're unafraid of the wounds, as it were. So there's that earthy realism that emanates from the theology of the cross. You know, we're not afraid of sin. You know, I have a clergy friend who grew up, let's see, who was baptized Methodist, confirmed Roman Catholic, was in Christian Science for a while, and was an organist in the Lutheran Church and fell in love with Lutheranism because of its realism, you know. Secondly, with the theology of the cross in the Lutheran tradition, there's an emphasis on the sovereignty of God's initiative. God takes the first step. You know, that's part of our practice, you know, heritage of infant baptism. God is working faith even in this little child who has no idea what's going on. God takes the first step, and, you know, God's initiative is a sovereign one. It will prevail. Thirdly, associated, related to the theology of the cross and the centrality of you know, Lutheran theology, is this whole notion of proleptic eschatology. Those who've been to Walt Bowman's sessions know what that's all about. He was one of my teachers in seminary. And proleptic eschatology, who can summarize in a sentence what that is? Come on, Frank. Bob?
How about the end crashing in now?
What's that?
The end crashing in now.
Okay, the end crashing in the now. Sometimes the term already but not yet is used. I mean, there's a sense in which in the cross, in its vindication, the resurrection, we have the fullness of salvation, but is not yet consummated until the end of time. So we're living in this, as the Germans say, Zwischendenzeiten, in between the times. Where we are saint and sinner, where we are struggling with good and evil, where it's a daily, you know, struggle to affirm our baptism. So again, that takes seriously, you know, the fact that human endeavors, and, you know, Bob, you know, put this well this morning in a session, that utopian human endeavors to create the perfect society just fail miserably, you know. Lutherans aren't into that stuff, you know, because we're zwischend den Zeiten, we're between the times. Anyway, that's all that stuff. This, of course, is rooted in the work of Paul. And if you'll indulge me, I'm just going to go through some texts, tracing the spirituality with an attitude, the spirituality for realists, through the tradition, you know, as it comes down to us in these latter days. Is that of interest? I mean, I'm going to read a little bit of Paul, talk about St. Augustine, do a little bit with Meister Eckhart, Martin Luther himself, Jakob Behme, one of the Lutheran mystics of the post-Luther time, Dag Hammarskjöld. Is that of interest? My sense in the last session I did is they liked some texts, so I will begin with Paul. Very familiar passages. First Corinthians chapter 1, at the second half of the 17th verse. I was called to preach the gospel, but not with eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. Where is the wise one? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach. I love that, because that, you know, no matter what I preach, if it's good or bad, still God is speaking through that, you see. Through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than us, and the weakness of God is stronger than us. And it goes on. That is where the theology of the cross is rooted. The foolishness, of course, is the cross. But it works wonders, you know. And it is, you know, the power and the glory of God in its fullness. St. Augustine. I love Augustine because he is an earthy realist struggling with, you know, his body, his sexuality, his, you know, do I marry? Do I become a priest? Do I, you know, how do I devote myself, you know, to Christ, to God? And how many have read the Confessions of St. Augustine? It's a wonderful little autobiography, if you will, of his conversion experience. And several points, you know, as he runs from God and rebels against God, and it takes some years finally to submit, you know, to God's pursuit. You know, Augustine speaks of God using his struggles, using his debased promiscuity, you know, as a means to draw him closer to God, using the vices of Augustine by God's grace and by God's initiative for that to become virtuous in his life. You know, there's that paradoxical stuff. There's that, you know, realism. There's that, you know, God reaching into the thick of who we are, not using our happy, precious moments, but our the opposite of that, you know, for the work of salvation. Meister Eckhart. Luther, of course, is indebted to Paul and to Augustine. Some also say, is it true Eckhart that Luther read Eckhart as a young man? What's that? Yeah, I've heard that too. And, you know, Luther apparently did a translation of the Theologica Germanica and was influenced by the mystical traditions of medieval time in his earlier, you know, life. But Meister Eckhart too echoes much of this. He writes, this isn't from an anthology. Now all of you reasonable people, take heed. The fastest beast that will carry you to your perfection is suffering. For no one will enjoy more eternal sweetness than those who endure with Christ in the greatest bitterness. There is nothing more gall bitter than suffering, and nothing more honey sweet than to have suffered. Nothing disfigures the body more than suffering, and nothing more adorns the soul in the sight of God than to have suffered. I like how Eckhart does not resolve the contradiction or the tension. You know, there is nothing more gall-bitter than suffering. It doesn't become good or pretty or redeemed in a penultimate sense. But at the same time, paradoxically, you know, it is a strange blessing. You know, it's that draws us, you know, closer, you know, to God. Luther himself. Yes, please.
I thought it was very interesting, you know, the paradox, two sides of suffering. He says the bad thing in present tense, I think. The good things about suffering was to have suffered.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Future perfect.
Which is quite interesting.
That's right.
Because when
you
don't
survive, you don't get to that place.
Well, when you're in the midst of it, it ain't so pleasant.
No, that's right. Precisely.
But
you know,
there can be a kind of a distillation of the experience that deepens the spirit, that deepens relationships too. Just want to toss in something very close to that. I talked in one of my classes about a doctor in the lay ministry that we talked about in our local church, getting people in their own callings to talk about their struggles and their callings as Christians. And then another doctor, Holden Village, came up to me exploring and said he was also an oncologist and had similar experiences as the guy that I talked about, and that he thought that you couldn't be a doctor without really being a pastor of the soul, particularly in dying cancer patients.
Right.
He told me a marvelous, just couple of sons' story, that he had just treated a person who had suffered for 2 or 3 years and dealt with him deeply and spiritually with the whole family. And at the end, very end of his life, just the last day or something, he told the doctor those were the best years of his life. I mean, that blows you away if you were a doctor, that those years of suffering were the best years.
Yeah, I read the right. That's right. Yeah, I read a quote before you came by John Carmody, who did a book called Right. Yeah.
Similar.
Right. Right.
So if suffering is so positive and
now, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Why don't we all do it?
and depth, you know, filling you with depth. Then why in our church and, well, the culture, but in the churches, why do we always try to alleviate that so much in ways that are, you know, well, don't feel bad, feel happy, or, you know, whatever it might be, don't cry, it'll be okay, it'll be better, and why don't we just let people suffer sometimes?
Yeah, that's a wonderful point and wonderful insight, and I think part of the, not all, but part of the inclination to help alleviate suffering is that I don't want to participate in that vicariously, so please don't cry in front of me because I don't want to suffer too. That's part of it, you know. I mean, nobody invites suffering. I mean, suffering happens. I mean, we get enough of it. We don't need to bring more on. But it's to deal as creatively as we can with that which we do. And I have to say, you know, at the time when my mother died, you know, the offerings of help, you know, just let me know what I can do, you know, John. If there's anything I can do, just call me, or you know, these kind of pious, gee, everything will be okay. I didn't want to hear it, you know. And that's, you know, and there's kind of an audacity that goes with this, you know, I don't want to suffer. I hate my mortality. I just had an incident earlier this fall. You shared this with the, you know, I ended up in the emergency room. Just had a, you know, full-time pastor, you know, done a difficult service, you know, funeral in the congregation. My cat was dying. I mean, just, you know, it's, you know, on top of each other, on top of each other, on top. And the cat, let me tell you, was, you know, that was, you know, she was my love of my life at that time. Ended up in the emergency room with a supraventricular tachycardia, rapid heartbeat. It was stress-induced, stress-related, caffeine-related. I thought I was dead. You know, the symptoms are that of impending death. You know, his rapid heartbeat, you know, feeling faint. And did I want that kind of, no, I don't want that experience. I don't want it ever to happen again, thank you. It brought me that much closer to age 33 with the fact that, yes, I am going to die. This thing beating in my chest is going to stop at some point. You know, I don't want to hear it. I want to run as far away from that as I can. but at the same time acknowledge that in the context of that experience, gee, did I learn how to settle down real quick, you know? And it became, in a sense, a strange kind of, an ironic kind of positive experience, which got me to think about my body, think about my finitude in creative ways, you know? So it's both and. The contradiction and the tension is still there. So, anyway.
Now, I was going to say, Gretchen's next to my wife, who's a first big wife, uh-huh. And she, I heard her talk with her clients about good pain, bad pain,
right.
Relative to the birth process, you mm-hmm. know, the pain of giving birth to a child, you know, you can drug it out of you, or you can allow this to happen, and that pain has positive benefits for you and the child, strangely
right.
enough, at the other end.
Right.
And as you say, spirituality is an attitude or suffering, it seems like other sorts of suffering we endure may not appear to be good pain like the birthing process,
right.
but the attitude is one that, well, maybe this is going somewhere, or maybe mm-hmm. even though it's not going in a good place, if I go with it, the attitude of faith will take it into a learning mm-hmm. place and it can become a good pain.
Yeah, and that is a decision that you can't preach to people and say, well, you'd better redeem your suffering here and make the best. You know, that has to be evoked, and the person has to come to that him or herself. The other thing I would say, and that made me think that in terms of the inclination to relieve suffering, I would say when the suffering is human-induced, the Holocaust, injustice, warfare, etc., yes, it's appropriate to try to alleviate that. There is enough suffering, you know, that's just part of life, you know, with our mortality to go around for us to learn from. We don't need to create more, you see. There is some suffering that cannot be alleviated, and that is the reality of our death. So, anyway, Martin Luther himself, of course, is the heir of Eckhart, Augustine, Paul, etc. So often we Lutherans, you know, write about and talk about Luther as reformer, Luther as historical figure, Luther as neurotic, Erik Erikson. You know, etc. Seldom have I heard people in our tradition talk about Luther, the person of prayer. And Luther was had an intense prayer life, and you know, his theological conclusions came right out of his personal struggle. Anfechtung is the untranslatable German word that has something to do with spiritual torment, you know. My God, I'm not good enough. I'm trying to be the perfect monk, and I realize that I fall short. You know, in that context, he had his Turm Erlebnis, the tower experience, you know, reading the book of Romans, the letter, you know, of Paul to Rome, and realized, gee, it's not my effort, but God's initiative, God's grace, God's sovereign love. So I like to look at Luther as a spiritual person, and a lot of that comes out of his hymnody. Aus tiefer Not, out of the depths, I cry to his paraphrase of, what psalm is that? Out of the depths I cry to you. What's that? Thank you. I knew Frank would know that. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Father, hear me calling. Incline your ear to my distress in spite of my rebelling. There's an important point. Do not regard my sinful deeds. Send me the grace my spirit needs. Without it, I am nothing. My soul is waiting for the Lord. Oops, wrong stanza. It is in God that we shall hope, and not in our own merit. We rest our fears in his good word and trust his Holy Spirit. His promise keeps us strong and sure. We trust the holy signature inscribed on our temples. There is Luther's poetic expression of spirituality with an attitude. Also, Ein feste Burg, you know, mighty fortress. I love the last stanza. God's word forever shall abide, no thanks to foes who fear it. For God himself fights by our side with weapons of the Spirit. If they take our house, goods, fame, child, or spouse, wrench our life away, they cannot win the day, the kingdom's ours forever. Let them have their way with me, you know, penultimately, because I trust audaciously, you know, in God's sovereign love, that God will usher in the consummated reign of God at the end time. And at that point, will have been, you know, things will be fine. And I trust that we'll all look at all of this and just laugh. You know, suffering still remains suffering, you know, but set in the larger context, you know, of God's consummated reign, you know, it pales in importance, I guess. You know, the mountain has become a molehill, as it were. Okay. let's see. Does anybody know the name Jakob Behme? One of the Lutheran mystics. What's that? Have you heard him? Okay. I read this for the first time, and in this Catholic university I'm doing my degree work in, and I had to say after reading, is this a Lutheran? It just did not sound, but let me just share one little bit. And he writes about Sophia, this Lutheran mystic, you know, wisdom, in dialogue with the soul. This is Sophia's response to the longing, troubled soul. My dear love and faithful treasure, he's a 17th century mystic, by the way. My dear love and faithful treasure, thou highly rejoicest me in thy beginning. I have indeed broken into thee through the deep gates of God, through God's anger, through hell and death, into the house of thy misery, and have graciously bestowed my love upon thee, and delivered thee from the chains and bonds wherewith thou wast fast bound. Spirituality with an attitude. Well, this continues through the centuries to be part of the legacy of the Lutheran charism, the Lutheran ethos, if you will. Dag Hammarskjöld. Everybody know the name. Secretary General of the United Nations in the century, Swedish Lutheran. On the face of it, nobody really knew that he was such a deep person of faith and piety. But he left you know, his autobiography called Markings. And he too embraces this kind of spirituality rooted in the theology of the cross. Let's see which bit I want to read here. Writing in Markings. I came to a time and place where I realized that the way leads to triumph, which is a catastrophe, and to a catastrophe, which is a triumph, that the price for committing one's life would be reproach, and that the only elevation possible to humanity lies in the depths of humiliation. After that, the word courage lost its meaning, since nothing could be taken from me. You know, this, and in the last stanza of Almighty Fortress, you know, harkens back to Paul, Romans chapter 8. Nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ. And he goes through that long laundry list. Nothing in life, death, you know, above or below. You make your own list. Nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ, rooted in the theology of the cross, because God has been there at the moment of our deepest, most significant losses. Also from Hammarskjöld. One of the themes in spirituality, you know, throughout, you know, classical Western, you know, practice of it, is the theme of the dark night of the soul. Have you all heard that? You know, those periods of dry time in the prayer life when, you know, prayer just doesn't mean anything. You know, going to Mass or going to Eucharist doesn't have the impact or the, you know, consoling quality it had at one point. Hammarskjöld recognized that and writes about it in this way. The dark night of the soul, so dark that we may not even look for faith. The night in Gethsemane, when the last friends left you have fallen asleep, all the others are seeking your downfall, and God is silent as the marriage is consummated. You know, here is you know, the depths for Hammarskjöld. And Hammarskjöld, of course, Swedish is melancholy. You know, all the Scandinavians are somewhat melancholy. You know, struggling with his life and his decisions and the fact that he was never able to achieve a meaningful relationship in his life. He's a very lonely man despite his worldly success, etc. You know, here is this dark night of the soul. Realizes God is silent in this. Can't even talk about faith. Yet, in spite of that, he affirms the marriage is consummated. there's a sense in which that darkness, that absence of God, in a strange sense, insofar as it evokes us and draws us yet closer in our yearning to be one with God. You know, is the marriage the consummation of the marriage of faith? Paradox. Oh, please.
I have a question.
Okay.
My mind's getting a little bit scrambled.
Paradox does that after a while.
Starting, you know, with this wonderful walk this morning and others along the way. Mm-hmm. And I want to hang on to this. When you just read there, something, the marriage is consummated. What's right before that?
Oh, let's see. Night in Gethsemane, when the last friends you have left are fallen asleep, all others are seeking your downfall, and God is silent.
Okay, God is silent. Okay, is that an analogy with what Walt read this morning about that horrible hanging? And when it came to the child, see, I don't get all this, but... Okay. The child, and you know, people walk by, and the child, of course, doesn't die for a half hour, and people are whispering, "Where is God? Where is God?"
Oh, in reference to Holocaust.
He is. What? How do they say? He is there. I mean,
in that hanging child.
He is the child suffering. So is that the same as the marriage is consummated thing?
Yeah. I don't know.
God is silent because he was silent. Mm-hmm. The dialogue this morning was like, "Where is God?"
Yeah.
Is that not equating?
Well, it relates to it, but I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the same. You know, because obviously the child hanging has no cognizance of what may be happening at more spiritual depths. So I wasn't there this morning. I was on my way back from Holden Lake. Mm-hmm. So.
That's okay.
Yeah, but it relates. Well, let me get into a bit of the Holocaust. I mean, you know, the spiritual life with an attitude is not the property of Lutheran solely. I mean, it's certainly thoroughly part of the Christian tradition, and elsewhere. Thank you. Do you know Eddie Hillesum? Eddie Hillesum. She's a Dutch. She was a Dutch Jew. Grew up in Amsterdam. Was university trained and very interested in the Christian tradition. But of course, as a Jew in the World War II period, you know, they were all being deported, you know, and many ended up in Auschwitz. So she left her diary called An Interrupted Life. And she shares with us a remarkable gift of her reflections about the presence of God in the midst of the suffering, which was the Jewish situation in Amsterdam during World War II. She writes in her diary, "And the funny thing is, I don't feel I'm in the Nazis' clutches anyway, whether I stay or I'm sent away. I find all that talk so cliché-ridden and naive and can't go along with it anymore. I don't feel in anybody's clutches. I feel safe in God's arms, to put it rhetorically, and no matter whether I am sitting at this beloved old desk now or in a bare room in the Jewish district, or perhaps in a labor camp under SS guards in a month's time, I shall always feel safe in God's arms. I may face cruelty and deprivation, the likes of which I cannot imagine in even my wildest fantasies. Yet all this is as nothing to the immeasurable expanse of my faith in God and my inner receptiveness. It is not as if I want to fall into the arms of destruction with a resigned smile. Far from it. I am only bowing to the inevitable, and even as I do so, I am sustained by the certain knowledge that ultimately they cannot rob us of anything that matters." And then later, that was in Amsterdam, later at Westerbork detention camp, July 3rd, 1943, she wrote, "All I wanted to say is this. The misery here is quite terrible, and yet late at night, when the day has slunk away into the depths behind me, I often walk with a spring in my step along the barbed wire, and then time and again, it soars straight from my heart. I can't help it. That's just the way it is, like something elementary, some elementary force. The feeling that life is glorious and magnificent, and that one day we shall be building a whole new world against every new outrage and every fresh horror, we shall put up one more piece of love and goodness. Spirituality with an attitude. She went on to Auschwitz, where she was killed. I would love to know her reflections, if she did it. I don't think she had occasion to write in Auschwitz, but I would love to know. I mean, the extremity of the suffering increased from the occupation in Amsterdam to the camp at Westerbork to Auschwitz. But, you know, here's a person of remarkable, audacious faith. Yes?
There is some suffering that cannot be redeemed or clarified or appropriated in this world. And I guess I'm asking a question. I make the proposition that there's a lot of suffering that doesn't make any sense to the people undergoing it, that doesn't have this moment of reflection where you see deeper elements of spiritual depth.
Well, even she isn't, she's not getting, in that reflection, she's not getting any of her sense of life from the suffering. She says the suffering here
is horrible.
Is horrible.
That's right.
But she, I mean, what she doesn't say is from whence is this spring in her step? And it seems to me that that may be one of the questions that needs to be asked in any kind of spirituality is what is it that gives you a sense of inspirited? That's what it means. Inspirited life or energy or whatever it is.
Yeah, part of it, my dissertation director is a Roman Catholic laywoman who's doing research now on the relationship between the theology of Karl Rahner and Holocaust survival literature. And the Holocaust survival literature asks the question, you know, despite the Viktor Frankl's and the others, you know, who survived and wrote about it, you know, and talked about the triumph of the human spirit, what about the millions who did not? You know, what is their story? And I think, Bob, you know, that is the unredeemable suffering, and the, what's lacking is the luxury, you know, the freedom in which to do any reflection. The Nazis were so skilled, you know, in their evil that they deprived the people in Auschwitz and elsewhere, you know, of any kind of freedom, you know, to engage in that kind of reflection. And Marie, my dissertation director, posits if there's any spirituality, it's in the physicality, you know, of just surviving. And the audacious, shameless, getting up in the morning, washing in the midst of this hell. You know, that, it becomes an embodied spirituality. That's also one of my topics next week. But
I guess what I also want to say is that because it ends so badly, and it can end so badly, does not mean that spoils the whole thing, or it does not mean that closes off the future.
Right.
I mean, we hope in God, and for some who suffer in an unredeemed way, or where there isn't any spring in the step or any shoots, that there's still a hope that God will make it good. That is not the last word. And it's often, toys in my soul that we're all headed toward disability, old age, and sometimes very, very bad endings. And that doesn't spoil what went on before.
Right.
And it doesn't spoil or doesn't close off all hope in the future.
But in the penultimate reality. Right.
Even in spite of the worst.
Yeah, and that, you know, that is why proleptic eschatology is so important. You know, that we're still in the midst of this hell, you know, and we boldly, shamelessly, foolishly, insanely, according to the world, hope for this consummated reign of God. And I guess that's the last thing. I do have a few more minutes, but the last thing I want to say about spirituality with an attitude is its audacity and shamelessness. You know, in the face of hopeless, despairing situations and the extremity of the 20th century, and it's not going to get better anytime soon in the 21st century.
I would think Luther would say that the source of our spiritual life is in the Word of God, because that lasts. God's Word is forever. And not in little moments of sugar cane
right.
but neither is it in necessarily in our suffering. That is, if in our suffering we can hang on to the Word of God, we still have something that lasts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the difference. I like to take on the guy that, I mean, I think what he's doing in the poem
mm-hmm.
or in his prayer, what they
John Carmody,
yeah,
or Felix Kinsler.
I mean, that's that whole thing about the poem that is based on the happy sin.
Mm.
Blessed be the time the apple was taken,
right.
because if it hadn't been taken, we would not have had Mary as our
right.
queen, and therefore we would never have known the bliss of being Christians or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that. Well, it's a nice poetic ploy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it could be argued that it might have been a more blessed time if the apple hadn't been taken.
Right.
And one could say it might be a more blessed time if he hadn't suffered the cancer.
Right.
But his ploy is that since I have the cancer,
right.
this can also be a blessed time.
That's right.
If in this time
That's I right. Yeah, and that leads right into comments I want to make about the dangers of spirituality
yeah.
with an attitude. I mean, it's well, let me preface
let's
that by saying,
let's
yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, spirituality is a very dangerous enterprise
yeah, I think so too.
Because you know I'm fond of saying now, you know, as pastor I've been around. I serve a wonderful congregation. I mean, they're beloved people. But as I look around other congregations and I don't know, 90% of religiosity is a lie. You know, is I don't. I mean, I'm overstating the case, you know, to be provocative. But you know, there's a large chunk of religious experience, religious enterprising, you know, religious activity, which is self-serving or promotes ideologies. You know, Bob, you touched on that in your sessions, and just is not the stuff of the gospel. You see, so I mean, first of all, spirituality is very dangerous. Secondly, spirituality with an attitude has its own dangers too. And it also is the danger of sugarcoating it, of baptizing suffering and say, oh, you know, God, you know, Christ died on the cross, he rose again, and therefore everything, you know, it's all fine, you know, and so let's beat ourselves even more. You know, let's suffer even then. You know, that's not it. To sugarcoat it, to baptize it, to trivialize it, to gloss over it, to render it conceptually manageable. You know, we're people of ideas and theories and words. And we want to put words to these experiences, and you know that runs the risk of putting in a box to say, okay, now I control it. I've named it. I can control it. It's manageable. Well, the Holocaust is not conceptually manageable. You know, it happened. It was evil. It may well happen again. It has happened of a sort before. You know, throughout human history. And so, God forbid, you know, that we say, oh, everything is going to be just fine, thank you, because Christ suffered and we can suffer too. I mean, it's very dangerous. And that's why, for me, you know, the tensions have to remain. The contradiction has to remain. It cannot be resolved. Paradox is a kind of embrace, but it doesn't eradicate the contradiction. Okay, does that speak to your concern? Yeah.
And this is probably not the right time to bring it up, but I guess I still am confused by you're linking spirituality and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought of spirituality as the ability to, you know, transcend, but also incorporate this life and God,
right.
and, you know, like the mystics or the poets, you know,
yeah.
to put it all together, you know,
mm-hmm.
and come to a much greater realization than
yeah.
precious moments.
Right, right.
And certainly suffering I can see as a possible way to get into that
right.
spirituality, but I guess I don't see that as any more, that it's just one of many possible ways to become
right.
a spiritual person
right. and the,
have
yeah.
a better understanding of it, and we seem to be seeing that.
Either or.
I don't understand the connection.
Yeah, I'm okay. I don't want to say exclusively, you know, suffering is the only way to go. I mean, you know, if you don't suffer, you have minimal suffering, you know, in your life, God bless you. You know, I envy you.
There are some of our poets and our, you know, religious, you know, that seem to have
surely,
gained
yeah.
that understanding.
Right. Yeah, and that's, you know, I'm talking about one kind of spirituality. You know, and there are many, many spiritual traditions, even within the Christian tradition. I think I'm arguing the direction for a Lutheran spirituality, which is distinct from Roman Catholic or the various kinds of Roman Catholic spirituality or Baptist spirituality or what have you. So we can only talk about one topic in an hour and barely that, you know. But yes, I acknowledge there are different, you know, routes and, you know, different perspectives.
But it seems like people who suffer have to test the envelope.
Right.
I mean, are really not by choice, but it really, when I read people like, you know, you've read to us, are people who have tested or have tested their faith and their spirituality to a much greater extent than thankfully I probably ever will. And for those who survived with something intact, probably very insights beyond what
And you use the word incorporate. When talking about this, you know, to incorporate, you know, life experiences, you know, into the spiritual life and use that as an opportunity to transcend. What I'm driving at, let's just incorporate, that is, embody everything, not just the good, but the bad. You know, and my concern is that in much of the history of spirituality, you know, the extent of the bad, the evil, has been ignored and glossed over.
That's why I use the word incorporate. You know, some mystics have no concern or interest in what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't what I wanted.
Right.
It's putting it all to you.
But is there a fine line? I could get nervous like I think Carol does.
No,
when you start talking about redeemed suffering.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I agree. I don't think there's any suffering that's redeemed, but you may have learned something through it. But.
And right. In fact, sometimes when I hear that kind of stuff, it says, feels your glory, right? When it's got
right.
The sign up, it says, watch
yeah.
out.
Yes, that's
you
right.
Know, that's just,
yeah, it's a
that's
pitfall.
Think,
it's a pitfall,
it's
and it's
really
easy, you know, it's an easy line to cross over into, you know, and God forbid we do, and that's why the tension has got to remain.
The other thing is that it's great to pick out the ones that are writers that have managed to experience if you will, redemption or some insights in spite of
mm-hmm.
the suffering they've been in, but there are just trillions of people that haven't, and I've met some
yeah.
of those. It's kind of like people who always talk about, well, isn't it wonderful how people get together in this crisis, and
right.
sentimental as...
Oh, you saw that immediately after Oklahoma City, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, just almost instantly, you know, people were struggling to look for the good that comes out of it. Oh, it's brought the community together, you know, as if that takes away the evil of what it. No, it doesn't.
It just doesn't work. So
that's right.
It seems to me that thank God that there are some people who can attest
mm-hmm.
for their ability to hang on to the faith.
Right.
Or let Jesus hang on to them
right. yeah.
throughout the suffering.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that that's what,
that's right.
What is the best
yeah.
Way to go if you can help it.
And
darken out the soul, I just do not have one, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anger is an appropriate part of the spiritual life and attitude.
Yeah.
You know, Job standing up and saying, you know, what the hell is going on here? You know, that is a very appropriate, you know, part of our prayer life. Anyway.
It seems like this picture of Billy Wazell fits in here, too.
Yeah.
When I've seen, as far as I can tell, when I've seen the sessions over there, he didn't redeem anything out of the Holocaust. Absolutely nothing. You know,
mm-hmm.
but he's got an attitude coming out of it.
Right.
And he says, I engage you as a scholar, and I got a whole lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what shaped my reality, but is there anything to die in there? Absolutely not.
Right, that's right.
But he refuses to look away.
Right. Okay. I hope you've not heard in my conversation that I'm trying to redeem suffering. I hope you've not heard that. Have you heard that from my? Okay.
Well, no, but you're on the line.
Oh yeah. That's right. That's right. You know, and it becomes audacious, shameless, bold. You know, angry, crazy. You know, from the perspective of the reign of God, and who knows once it's consummated, you know, what this will all look like. You know, but let me close with one more little summary of spirituality with an attitude. The Russian Orthodox do it too. They have a wonderful hymn for All Souls Day. I presume they also use it at funerals, etc. Where Frank, do you know the Kentuckian of the Dead? Okay, it's a wonderful hymn. You know, talking about yes, we are dust, and to dust we shall return. You know, God has created us mortal, and you know, yes, we will go down to the dust. And it concludes with these words.